acting wasn't hard to me because, again, I did a lot of public speaking. And, you know, as you know, being a public speaker, you're on a stage and you're in front of people and you have to perform. And it's the same thing being on a movie set. You're on a proverbial stage. There's crew all around and you have lines and you have to perform. So one thing I would just always do is, and I still do to this day, is I always go back to my reference points. I always say, you know what? Because you did A, now you can do B. That foundation has already been set.
What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance. So you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Darris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio.
Hey there, Rian Darris here. Welcome to Flow Research Collective Radio. On today's episode, we have someone who really is the embodiment of peak performance over the long haul. You may know today's guest, Remy Adelke, from the movie Transformers or from his really great book, Transformed. And the subtitle of that book is A Navy SEAL's Unlikely Journey from the Throne of Africa to the Streets of the Bronx to Defying All Odds, which really sums Remy up nicely. Now, the question that we delve into today is, what does it take for one young man to become a Navy SEAL, an actor, an entrepreneur, a writer, and a successful, happy husband and father? And that's the story that Remy shares with us today on this podcast. We go deep and we go wide. We talk about the peak performance lessons that Remy learned dealing drugs in the Bronx, the most difficult aspects of Hell Week when he was training to become a Navy SEAL, and what it's like to work in Hollywood with his involvement in the movie Transformers. So you're going to really enjoy today's episode. I'm confident of that. Remy is inspiring. He's full of life. You'll see what I mean in a couple of moments. I think it's going to be a blast for you. So stay tuned to the end. Now, before we dive in, I want to make a quick announcement. We are currently accepting a number of new participants into our flagship peak performance training, Zero to Dangerous. In Zero to Dangerous, you work one-on-one with one of our PhD level peak performance coaches, and they will help you implement the flow practices and protocols that are neuroscience backed and that are needed to level up your game and to work towards spending your entire workday in flow. You'll also master the maps and models of peak performance through our online curriculum, and you'll get lifetime access to live weekly group coaching calls with our PhD level coaches. So if you're an entrepreneur, a leader, or a knowledge worker, and you want to take your professional success to the next level, all while creating more time and space and freedom in your personal life, Zero to Dangerous could be for you. To apply for Zero to Dangerous, just go to getmoreflow.com to assess whether it's a good fit for where you're at right now. That's getmoreflow.com. One more time, get, G-E-T, more, M-O-R-E, flow, F-L-O-W.com. And you could pop a quick application through there. It takes about 30 seconds, and we would be excited to speak with you. Now, let's jump into the episode today. I would love to kick off this episode with, is the story of Remy, in your own words, from day one to now, and feel free to go as long or as short on that. It's totally up to you.
First and foremost, thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor and a blessing to be sharing with this amazing team. And Steve, you know, thank you so much as well. My story kind of starts a lot. It really starts with my dad's story. I tell people all the time, my dad, he was a firstborn son to my grandfather. And my grandfather was a chief and a hero of a tribe in European culture. In Western culture, royalty is referred to as king, queen, prince, princess, Dutch, that sort of thing. But in West African culture and a lot of African culture, royalty is referred to as chief in your last name. So my father was a firstborn son to my grandfather. But unfortunately, my grandfather died when my father was 8. And my grandmother brought him down to the south of Nigeria, and there happened to be missionaries there. And not only did they teach the Bible, but they taught science and math and literature and all these different things. And my dad ended up, you know, bedazzling the missionaries. And long story short, he ended up getting a full ride scholarship to study engineering and architecture in London. He went to the West and he excelled in school. He started to build a lot of wealth and a lot of different businesses. He was the jack of all trades. He's one of the first Black men on the board of the World Trade Center in New York City. He was the first Black man on the board of the Financial Planning Council in Great Britain. And then after, you know, a decade or so, he wanted to come back to Nigeria in order to kind of build Nigeria up so that it would be a beacon for all of the world to look to, because he hated the false narrative that, you know, Africans are a bunch of uneducated bush people. And so he went back to Nigeria, and this is when I came along. My mother was American. She met my dad at the Metropolitan Museum of Natural History while he was doing some work on the World Trade Center. They got married 5 months later, and my mother moved to Nigeria. And I tell people all the time, my mom and dad's story is a real coming to America story. And so they got married, and then my brother was born before me, and then I was born. So when I was born into wealth. We had cars, we had nannies, we had drivers. We lived on a compound. My father hosted lavish parties for expatriates and politicians from all around the world. I mean, we had it all. And my dad had invested a good chunk of his money in this project called the Lagoon Development Project, which was one of the first man-made islands in the world. It exists to this day. It's known as Banana Island. But unfortunately, after the land had formed, the Lagos state government essentially came to my dad and said, hey, you know, the federal government was never allowed to give you this land, even though you paid for it. It cost £8 million. So they stripped it from him. And my dad had to not only invest £8 million in acquiring the area, the lagoon, but he invested millions in signing contracts and construction, all these things. So much so that my mother would tell my father all the time, listen, you need to put some money in the States, because if something happens here, you know, we're going to lose everything. But my father was so loyal to his country that he would tell my mother often, let's get this island taken care of first, and then we'll put all the money we need to put in the States. Well, when the Nigerian government did what they did, my father ended up dying a few weeks later, and we went from rich to poor. We had absolutely nothing. And my mother, you know, being an American, she decided that there was no way she was going to raise my brother and I in Nigeria. So she permanently relocated us to the States. Hence my journey and my time in the Bronx. And that was in 1987. I was five at the time. So grew up in the Bronx and, you know, not having a father, I got involved in some bad things. I started out stealing from my mother and, you know, just trying to find that paternal influence. You know, I followed some bad archetypes. I started out stealing from my mother, and that progressed to stealing from stores, that progressed to stealing from jobs, that progressed to selling drugs, and that progressed to running high-level scams. And by the time I was 19, I had built this massive illegal enterprise where I was bringing in thousands of dollars a week, selling drugs and also selling electronic devices on the black market. And my wake-up call came when I got involved in a deal with a drug dealer that went bad. Some products that were supposed to last for a certain amount of time. They only lasted for a fraction of that time. And he came knocking on my door and threatened my life. But it was a blessing, because that was my wake up call. I made him his money back. And then I made the decision. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to get out of this life. And for 6 months, I did nothing. And then finally, I felt the call to go into the military. And eventually, I felt the call to go into special operations as a Navy SEAL. Even though I was totally unqualified in every way, I couldn't swim. I didn't have the academic scores. I was super skinny, but, you know, I just had this fire within me just to reach for greatness and acquire greatness. And so, you know, I put the pedal to the metal when I got to my first command, which was Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton in California. And, you know, within a year of checking into that command, I was checking out, which is unheard of. I was checking out and I was going to SEAL training, and got to SEAL training, made it through first phase, made it through Hell Week. Pride got the best of me. Instead of working on what I needed to work on the weekend, I was partying and chasing girls and telling girls at the bar I was a Navy SEAL when I wasn't. I ended up getting kicked out of SEAL training, which, again, that was a huge failure, but it was a blessing. And that was the first time in my adult life, I think, that I took responsibility for my actions and my failure. And I learned that, you know, I could turn this failure around by applying the lessons that I gained out of it. And so I ended up going back to Camp Pendleton. This time I was stationed in the infantry with 1st Marine Division. I did my time there. Which was a year, a couple months. And I went back to SEAL training, made it through SEAL training, had a great opportunity to serve on the West Coast for 8 years in the SEAL team, 7.5 to 8 years in the SEAL teams. Went all over the world and was able to do cool things. And in 2016, around 2016, 2015, 2016, I was a father at this point, and having been a son who lost his father, I wanted to be in my two boys' lives as much as I could. And so I made the hard decision to get out of the SEAL teams in January 2016. I thought I was going to go into public speaking and other consulting type ventures, you know, taking principles that I learned in the SEAL teams and translating them into business and sports. And I kind of did that, but it wasn't as fruitful as I thought it would be. And then, you know, I got the call from Hollywood to work on a film called Transformers. Worked on that film as an actor, but primarily as a consultant. And that just opened up a lot more doors for me, having worked on such a big scale project, and started working with other directors as a consultant. And then that began to gradually morph into writing because of my book. I wrote my book, but then that writing my book kind of morphed into writing films, screenplays, teleplays. And then that kind of morphed into now producing. And hopefully in the next few months, I'll find out shortly directing. So that's kind of been my trajectory, and that's kind of where I am today.
Epic, man. Some journey from the Lagoon Project the whole way up to writing the book. That's wild.
Yeah.
All right. I got to jump in with a handful of questions right away, even before I let Rian get started, because otherwise he'll just go for 20 minutes. And I won't
get it.
I want to know a couple of things. First, I want to know, one of the things that really intrigued me about your career, and one of the reasons I was really excited about talking to you, is whether or not it's a good group of skills, being a drug dealer is hard. It's a set of skills. It's not an easy job. The competition is ferocious. Blah, blah, blah. You then go into the teams, which is a totally different beast, sort of different set of skills. Some apply, some don't. Learn that. And then you go into acting and then writing. Those are four totally different careers, four really sort of different skill sets. But I want to know what crosses over. What do you take from one to the next, to the next, to the next? And how do you do that? Like, when you carry over, because obviously you're very good at it. Very few people get to have that many careers at the level that you've had. You've had a lot of careers at a very high level. So there's something from a performance perspective, there's some stuff you're doing that's consistent. So I'd like to start there and dig in there if you don't mind.
No, 100%. I think a lot of it is intuitive. You know, growing up in the Bronx is a very, very hard environment to live in. And as you said, you know, selling drugs is not an easy occupation. And one thing that I did do at that time is I realized the risk in it. And that's why I stopped selling drugs in the Bronx. And I moved to selling drugs up in upstate New York because there was.
The smartest drug dealer I've talked to in a long time.
So I say a lot of it was intuitive, and I think a lot of it came from my father, just this ability to take these concepts and translate them. So, you know, having grown up in a really rough environment, and when I got to SEAL training, it was just, yes, it was hard, but it was, for me, it was just like, I've already lived this, in a sense. I've already had this life. And that was something that I would say to myself all the time. Remy, there were times when your mom didn't have enough food to feed you and your brother. There were times when you were jumped and beat up and you know, almost, and shot at and all of that. That was hard. So this is, it's hard, but you've been through worse. And so I would always use my past as a reference point. And then even, you know, translating into acting, like acting wasn't hard to me because, again, I did a lot of public speaking. And, you know, as you know, being a public speaker, you're on a stage and you're in front of people and you have to perform. And it's the same thing being on a movie set. You're on a proverbial stage. There's crew all around and you have lines and you have to perform. So one thing I would just always do is, and I still do to this day, is I always go back to my reference points. I always say, you know what? Because you did A, now you can do B. That foundation has already been set. And it's the same thing with writing. You know, when I was getting ready to write my book, because I wasn't supposed to write my book. The plan was my mother was going to write my book because my mother has been a creative writer for, you know, since I was a kid. But when it was time to put pen to paper, I was taken back to when I was in intelligence school. Because in every SEAL platoon, every SEAL has a specialization. And I had two specializations. One, I was a medic, but two, I was an intelligence collector. So I went through all of these different intelligence schools. We call it human. Which is human intelligence. And one of the first schools I went to, literally for hours, you're in a room with no windows, double locked doors where you got to put codes in, and you're writing long intelligence reports. And they have to be written in a specific format, and they have to be written in a way where somebody years from now could pick up that report and read it as though it happened that day. And if it's not done to the point of perfection, either A, you're going to have to do it all over again, that report, and it takes hours, or B, you're going to get kicked out of the program. And the last thing you want to happen is go back to your SEAL team having gotten kicked out of, you know, any course, whether it's a sniper course, a medical, you don't want to go back. That's just a bad look. And so when I was writing, I was able to go back to that point when I was sitting in this room with no windows, and it was hard and I was tired, but I had to keep going because I had a job that I had to learn and I had a job that I had to do. And I was able to refer to that point. And when I was sitting at this very computer writing my book, I was able to say, you know what? I did it worse. That was harder. I was on a more stringent timeline. The stakes were harder. And then when I went overseas and actually did the job of an intelligence guy, the stakes were even more higher, because now I'm collecting intelligence and I'm having to write reports that's going to lead to missions. And those missions can play a role in people living or dying, right? So for me, how do I translate these skills is I kind of file them away. Once I do something, I try to file it away in my mental cabinet and say, okay, this is the foundation. I've done A. I may not do this ever again. I may not use it again, but I'm going to file it away. So if I have to use it, I have that reference point. And, you know, again, this is something I try to tell people all the time. Don't despise small beginnings, even if it's something where if you're working at McDonald's and your job is to mop the floor and you're just like, it sucks that I have to mop the floor. You know what? There's a lesson that you could take in this. And this is something I try to teach my assistant all the time, because there's a job that he does for me as it relates to social media, and he hates it. And we talk about it all the time, but he hates it because it's very tedious and he has to do it for hours. But I tell him, I say, listen, Brad, listen, I know it sucks, but you are building up these calluses, these mental calluses. And so when you get to a point where you have to do something similar to this, or maybe something different than this, that sucks for a long period of time, you're going to be able to say, you know what? I did the social media job for running for 4 hours a day and it sucked. I could do this. So I'm sorry. I know I said a lot, but, and I'm not sure if this is your question, but that's what I'm
like. Great answer. Two things. One, if anybody listening, whatever the hell they were teaching you about writing intelligence, like, I'm blown away. I mean, it makes sense. Yes. Transformed is awesome, people. Like, he can really write, which is a crazy thing in and of itself. It's awesome. And those intelligence reports, all I have to say is they must have been really, really straight. I get it. If you would absolutely have to write it for somebody 10 years from now, I can understand how. Because one of the things, you know, when you read people who haven't written books before, they have a hard time being very clear, painting pictures. Those are things you did very well. Now I understand it. The other thing you said that really stayed with me, I say this, I think it's one of the hardest lessons in peak performance is to teach people to trust their own history.
Yes.
Right? We all have it. We don't realize it's the tool, right?
100%. And on top of that, even within that history, if there has been a failure or some high level of pain or rejection or whatever you want to call it, something negative, using that as fuel. And I say that to say, my publisher, they didn't want me to write the book because the expectation was this guy, and I'm not saying this to be rude or call him out, it's just the facts, it's just the way it worked out. This guy has never written a book before.
They didn't think a drug dealer from the Bronx could write a book?
Exactly. in their defense, right? And so in my mind, when we had that first meeting and they were like, just like, you know, we don't want you to do this, that was fuel for me. So in my mind, I was just like, I want to prove them wrong. I want to show them that I can do this. Every time I got stuck or I had, and I hate to use the term writer's block or whatever it was, or I was procrastinating, I always went back to, they don't think you can do this, right? They don't think you can do this. Show them you can do it. And in all honesty, that has been my entire life. My entire life has been, and I think that this is one of the reasons why I say this humbly, why I've been successful to a certain extent, is because I have been written off so many times in my entire life. When we left Africa, there were family members who said they will never make it. Okay? I remember being in high school, in school, and there were teachers who would say, you'll never get out the Bronx. You'll never graduate high school. You'll never go to college. You know, when I wanted to get into the military, I had warrants out for my arrest, and I was essentially told, you'll never be able to get into the military. You'll never be able to get a security clearance. When I couldn't swim, I was told, you'll never be able to be a Navy SEAL, right? So, like, literally, and to this day, I still get phone calls from people saying, yeah, Remy, I know you got this idea, but that'll never, ever work. You'll never be able to do this. And so for me, instead of letting that get to me and say, oh, yeah, that's right, I use that along with my reference points. I use that as fuel to be like, oh, really? Okay, roger that.
Oh, yeah. No, my wife has on our refrigerator, she's taped up a fortune cookie that says, I get great pleasure out of proving other people wrong.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
I wrote a newsletter, a blog about it, the difference between using like small S spite, which is what you and I are talking about as a motivator, versus capital S spite. Yes. Right? And capital S spite will eat you alive, right? You can't be driven on that. But, you know, the bulletin board material, to use the football reference, right? Like, at this point, like when somebody doubts me, like there's a part of me at the inside that's like, well, thank you very much.
Yes. Right?
Like now I know I'm going to get it done. Like before you doubted me, it was, you know, 50-50, but now you like it's done. Thank you.
100%. 100%. You're doing me a favor.
Yes, sir. Remy, it sounds to me like, yeah, you've developed mastery of the skill of extracting lessons from all of these experiences, accumulating them. I love the way you talk about a filing cabinet.
Yes.
And then reapplying them across different areas. What I'm curious is, what were the lessons that you pulled from your time in the Bronx, getting up to no good, and put in that filing cabinet that you still use today? Are there any principles or habits from dealing?
I would say that a big one is reading people, man. Reading people, because, you know, growing up in the streets, man, you got to learn how to read people quick or you're going to be robbed, beat up, killed, taken advantage of, whatever. You have to learn how to read people. And you learn the difference between somebody who is BSing and somebody who's legitimate. One of the things that I learned big time in the Bronx, and this really played a role in me in SEAL training, was the difference between the loudmouth and the quiet person. In the Bronx, the guy who's always rah, rah, and I'll do this, I'll kill you, blah, blah, like, that guy is usually the weakest person. The most terrifying people that I came across in the Bronx were the quiet ones, were the ones who everybody would speak about their reputation, but they never did. So when I got to SEAL training, I'll never forget this, I was really able to identify the instructors that were the ones to really watch out for and the ones who I could kind of maybe I'll be able to get away with a little something, something. Because the ones who were quiet, those were the killers, man. Those were the guys that you do not want to screw up. You want to make sure your knife is sharpened. You want to make sure your uniform is crisp. Because if not, they're going to... But the ones who were, you know, rah, 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 yeah, we're going to hand you that. Those are the ones that I learned that you can, you know, yeah, they're going to be hard on you to a certain extent, but there's room there. You have more room there. And so I would say, you know, that's the big lesson I even use to this day is reading a room. And we call it, the term is emotional intelligence, right? Is being able to figure out what is this person feeling or what is this person thinking? Or is this person lying? Is this person telling the truth? Looking cues. And then obviously you haven't gone through intelligence school. I had to learn how to, you know, body language and all that, because I was running sources overseas. So I had to learn, you know, whether, and that's why I think I was good at doing what I did overseas, because of the fact that I could tell when the source was.
How much do you think the body language, this is an open question in like the face reading psychology and the body reading, how accurate did you notice a match between what you were trained in and what you were actually experiencing in the field? Was it solid? Did it compare to the education you received in the Bronx? Did it match?
I would say in some areas, yes, and in some areas, no. I think experience trumps education at times. And so there were through lines. So there were absolutely through lines between reading people in the Bronx, what I learned in intelligence school, and then what I saw overseas. But then there were those anomalies at times where, you know, and a lot of it was based off of bringing my experiences from the streets and marrying that with my training and then finding these anomalies that didn't necessarily line up because I was approaching the situation from a completely different perspective. Case in point, one thing that I would say was an anomaly that I didn't really learn in training, but I think I picked up in the streets, was how humor could really help someone open up more. I didn't really learn that in training. And as case in point, and I mentioned this in my book, when I got overseas for one of my deployments, I learned that a lot of the guys that I work with, the locals that I work with, they watch black comedy. They watch black, you know, TV. Eddie Murphy, they couldn't tell you what he was saying, but they knew who Eddie Murphy was. They knew who Bernie Mac was. They knew who Martin Lawrence was, like all of these people. Because I remember walking into the room for the first time in one of my meetings, and one of the guys chuckled and laughed. And I asked my interpreter, why is he laughing? And he said, because he thinks you look like Eddie Murphy. And so what I would start to do, which I didn't learn this in training and didn't line up, is I just begin to act like that. I would go in these rooms at times and be like, yo, what's up? Like, hey, what's going on? I got one. And they didn't teach that, didn't line up with training, because there were guys who were looking at me like, what the hell?
There's a guy in the corner going, man, why is he quoting Coming to America? What's up?
Exactly. Why is this guy doing that? But it helped build a rapport. It helped bring down the tension, and it helped them a lot more. And I got a lot of information by not going into the room, starting following these formats that were taught, and they were good and they would work, but not following that format and saying, you know what, let me use my street knowledge, because laughter is a pill. Laughter can heal anything. And so, you know, that's what I would do. So that's where that is a case in point where I didn't see what I learned in the school line up with what I did overseas.
Rem, I'd love if you could give us a day in the life of Hell Week, all the way down to what you have for breakfast, if possible.
As far as Hell Week, the day in the life of Hell Week, Hell Week starts as, Hell Week is, I don't even want to say it's a day in the life, because Hell Week is just one long day.
Long blur.
It starts on Sunday in the evening, and it ends on Friday, and you get 2 hours of sleep on Wednesday, if you could even fall asleep by Wednesday, and you get 2 hours of sleep on Thursday, if you could fall asleep by Thursday. It's just torture. At the end of the day, what the instructors are trying to do is they're trying to expose you to extreme stress. They're trying to put you in a situation where you have absolutely no choice but to work as a teammate alongside other men in the program. And it's just, it's torture. It's pain. It's cold. They keep you cold and wet the entire time. You eat, for the most part, you eat MREs, which are cold and hard and disgusting. I mean, again, the goal is to make you miserable as you could ever be, so that in a case, good case in point, as a reference point, if you ever find yourself in a situation overseas, whether you're outnumbered or your guys have been shot or whatever the case may be, you're able to say, you know what, I've been through worse. I've been through Hell Week. And that's the unique thing about Hell Week, is that every Navy SEAL has gone through Hell Week. So when you get overseas, you can be thrown in a platoon with new SEALs, and you all have that same reference point. You all know that you've been through the hardest thing in the military, and you know that you, as a team, you'll be able to get the job done. But again, it's tough, but it's good. It's a great, it's a weeding out process. The attrition rate is really, really high. I can't remember how many guys we lost in Hell Week during my class, but I can say that we started out with 270 and graduated 29. And that's the same with every SEAL training class. It'll start out with 250, 300. And by the time Hell Week is over, you know, you'll have maybe 40 guys, 30 guys, 20 guys. It was Hell Week in January. They only graduated 15 guys from Hell Week. So it's not fun.
What was the most challenging bit? And I'm curious as to what was your internal dialogue during the trickiest bit? What were you saying to yourself in your mind?
100%. So the most challenging part of Hell Week for me was the cold, because they keep you wet and cold. There's this evolution called surf torture, where they lay you, and they do this constantly throughout Hell Week. They lay you in the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but even in the summertime, the Pacific Ocean is still cold, because that water comes down from Alaska.
And it's you were in San Diego. Yeah, that water's cold. I've surfed blacks and things like that, which is right off. It's cold.
So you know the deal. Even, and so imagine the wintertime. And so, you know, not having any body fat, you know, that cold water was
worse. I was going to say, by the way, most of the SEALs I've known are thick. Not necessarily huge, but thick. Yeah. If you're a skinny SEAL, you have to be twice as tough for the cold. That has to be, right?
100%. 100%. And I wouldn't say I was super skinny, but I was skinny with muscles. You know, and so, and that's why, you know, the cold got to me. But what I would always say to me, say to myself is, there were a few things. One, I would always say, I have nothing left. I have nothing left. I talk about this all the time with people, especially young kids, is when you have a dream or a goal, whatever it is that you want to do in life, you have to have a deep-rooted emotional reason as to why you want to do it. Because when challenges come, if you have a superficial reason as to why you want to do whatever it is that you want to do, when those trials come, those superficial reasons are going to turn into bad ideas, and that bad idea is going to lead you walking away. But when you have a deep-rooted emotional reason as to why you want to do something, when adversity and extreme adversity hits, that deep-rooted emotional reason why is going to anchor you. It's going to keep you there. And so for me, my deep-rooted emotional reason why was, Remy, you have nothing left. Remy, you have failed so much in the past, you can't fail again. Remy, people are expecting you to fail. And so every time things got hard, I would just remind myself of that. And speaking of Hell Week, you know, we have a saying in the SEAL teams, and you may have heard this before, eat the elephant one bite at a time. How do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? And essentially, you're breaking up these goals into incremental goals that once you achieve those incremental goals, it boosts your confidence. It gives you more motivation to get to the next goal. And so what the instructors will do in Hell Week is they will play with your mind by saying, I mean, the first hour of Hell Week, they throw absolutely everything at you. And they will say things like, this is just the first hour and you guys still have 6 days left. And what guys will do is guys will focus in on that point and they will say, oh my God, 6 more days, Friday. So they get Friday stuck in their mind and those guys quit. Versus like a guy like myself, one thing I was always thinking about in conjunction with I have nothing left is I just need to make it to the next evolution. So if I was getting surf tortured, my goal was, Remy, get to log PT. And while I was on log PT doing 12-mile run down the beach with the logs and it felt like my arms were going to explode and my back was killing me, Remy, just get to boats on heads. And same thing. So I was always setting these incremental goals. And as I achieved those incremental goals.
I just have to say, the idea of going log torture to boats on heads as a motivator, really, like, it tells you you can use anything, right? Anything. It doesn't really matter.
Anything. And that was essentially... those were my two mantras. You have nothing left and just get to the next thing. And another thing that motivated me through that was when guys who were faster than me, when guys who were way better swimmers than me, I mean, there were guys in my class who were triathletes. There were guys in my class who played Division I, you know, who swam Division I at their college. And I mean, they were just top notch pro. I mean, they could crush me in every aspect of sports and physicality. And when those guys would quit, and I'm this kid from the Bronx who just learned how to swim, you know, that was just like, Remy, I mean, you're better than it. You made it. You outlasted them. So that was another thing that drove me.
Epic, man. What do you think some of the things that are common to everyone who made it through are? Because obviously you presumably get to know the guys afterwards who actually end up making the cut pretty well.
Yeah.
What are some of the common denominators or the similar patterns that you've seen in everyone who got through it?
Yeah, so one, a deep-rooted emotional reason why. The second thing is that I haven't touched on is this ability to operate within a team-type environment. A lot of people don't realize this, but SEAL training is not as much of an individualistic program as people may think. It's a team-based program. And so you have guys who show up to SEAL training, and in order to succeed, yes, you have to be able to pass your 4 mile time run. Yes, you have to be able to pass your O course, but you have to be able to get through a log PT evolution, which is 7 guys on a log. And you need to be able to run down a beach with that log or do lunges with that log. You need to be able to do boats on heads, which with boats on heads, you're running down the beach and you have to literally be in sync, because if you're not in sync, the boat bounces, right? And so as the boat is bouncing, that's pressure on your neck. It's already painful, but it's even more pressure. And then if you have a guy on the boat crew who's ducking boat, which is he has his head down, that's causing more pain on the other guys. So you have to really be able to operate within a team. And because we live in a very individual, especially now, more so now than, you know, decades past, but because we live in such an individualistic culture and society, and especially this young generation, it's all about me, 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 me. How can I get ahead? It's about me, me. You know, when these guys show up to SEAL training and they have this individualistic mindset, they're not able to adapt. And when they're not able to adapt, they don't make it. And so that other common thread I found was this innate ability to be able to operate within a team environment, to pull your weight, but also be willing to help pull somebody else's weight if the time comes, and show empathy and communicate and have leadership at every level. Like, that is integral. At the end of every SEAL unit is that word team. SEAL Team 3, SEAL Team 4, SEAL Delivery Vehicle Teams, SRT Team. Every SEAL unit ends with that word team, because that's the foundation of our community. We have a saying in BUDS: individuals fail, teams survive.
Well, I mean, what is it? I've talked a lot about this with different team guys, but what do you think are the foundational? I'm not talking about what gets you through BUDS. I'm talking about being in the field with teams. What is it that makes a great team?
For me, the big one for me is knowing your teammates. Knowing your teammates, and I don't mean like you have to know every personal detail about them, but having a knowledge of who they are, their likes, their dislikes. And to me, why that's important is because when you get in a situation when you have to bring a word of correction to your teammate, you're going to know how to communicate that to them because you know them. Or when it comes to you having to receive that information, you're not going to take it the wrong way because you know where that teammate is coming from. So for me, one of the most important aspects of a team, of an effective team, is knowing your teammate and knowing their operational threshold. Another essential element of a team is communication, which kind of ties into what I just said, but it's not just about what you communicate, it's about how you communicate what you communicate. Being able to communicate in different ways, being able to communicate with different people in different ways so that they receive the message properly, operating within your role and responsibility. And that's one thing that makes SEAL teams effective. Within every SEAL unit, every single person has a role. You have the sniper, you have the medic, you have the OIC, officer in charge, you have the AOIC, you have a breacher, you have drivers, you have all these different roles. And in order for that team to be successful, each guy has to be able to operate within that role, and every other guy has to trust that that teammate can operate within that role. Case in point, I went on a deployment, I won't say where, I won't say when, but it was just 8 of us. Because of the rules within the country that we were working in set a cap, and there could only be 8 Navy SEALs in this particular country. Our closest QRF, which was a quick reaction force, was on another continent. There was an embassy, but that embassy ended up getting evacuated at some point. But I say all that to say, we all, the 8 of us in this country, we all had to know how to operate within our role and responsibility and trust that the guy to our right and left could do the same thing. It had the potential to mean life or death if we couldn't. So that's another element to me of an effective team. And I think that's what makes SEALs and other special operations groups great, is our ability to know our role, study our role, and be effective in our role for the benefit of the whole team, not just ourselves.
I've had a lot of fun taking sort of team-based after-action review ideas into companies of mine, and even into my own life. I grew up as a journalist, right? Yeah. That was my early career. And I was a freelance writer, so I worked for, you know, hundreds of editors. And as a general rule, they're not particularly nice. They're busy. They've got, you know what I mean? They're not going to hold my hand. There's a job, right? The job is to make the copy sing and get on to the next story kind of thing. So I took, like, there's nothing you can say to me at this point that I haven't heard like 1,000 times worse. And I find, you know, people who don't come up in a culture with that. I find it, it's hard. It's difficult to work with them also because I'm like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to step around your feelings so we can do the job that we're supposed to do. Right. It's a tough transition into the real world after you've done something that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm 100%. And it's so funny because me and my assistant joke about it all the time, but it's just like, and he has to tell, he's never been in the military, which is a good thing because he's like my filter. Cause there's sometimes he's like, well, Remy, like, I know where your heart is coming from, but you can't bring this word of correction to this organization or to this partner or whatever. And I'm like, why not? They're like making a massive mistake. He's like, because they're not going to receive it well. Let me do it. Right? And it's not even I'm coming to them in a rude tone or disparaging tone. Or anything. It's just like, no, this is the truth. They made a mistake. They need to know that this was a mistake. And for me, like to this day, it's challenging. It is very, very challenging because everybody is like, they wear their feelings on their sleeves. And it's just like, I don't get it. I don't understand it. But it's just like, nobody wants to receive what they need to receive. And it's always taken the wrong way. So how do I deal with it? To be honest with you, my assistant, he's the filter. I just say, hey, dude, you go have the conversation.
Sure. Brad. I feel bad for Brad.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, as you know, it's challenging.
It's challenging. You know, it's interesting. Group flow, which is team flow, right? When a whole part of flow state together has triggers. There are 10 known triggers for group flow and they've been known for a little while, worked out for a little while. It's, you know, interesting. I always ask people who work on teams, what are the secrets? And invariably, a lot of the things you live, like good communication is a group flow trigger, right? And shared common languages is a group flow trigger. And that includes nonverbal languages and understandings, tics and tendencies and all the little stuff. I think it's hard also. I think it's interesting what you said. There's something really difficult that you didn't talk about it being difficult, but it is really difficult. It's worth going into, which is it's one thing to learn to speak to people in different languages, right? It's another thing to be able to do that in a combat crisis situation when your words have to be confused, right? Communicate when everybody has to really understand you, and yet you have to actually switch languages. That's a difficult skill. I don't think people listening realize that, like, it's all easy to be super empathetic and friendly and whatever. When they start shooting at you, it is not. Yeah. It is a totally different ballgame.
Yep, 100%. No, 100%. It's, for me, like, I have to try and go back to those reference points and those lessons learned, you know, in the past, to figure out how to attack that. And again, I'm still learning, you know, I think I'll be learning for a long period of time just because I think the world is changing. You know, the world is changing every single day. I mean, it's warp speed, especially now with social media and technology. And it's just like, I think that it's going to be a process of continued learning to try and catch up and continue to keep up with the trends, especially as it relates to communication.
All right. I hope you are enjoying hearing Remy's story. Just going to interrupt him for one quick moment because I want to tell you about a new free masterclass that we've got. It is called The Passion Recipe. And we know passion is a word that gets thrown around a lot these days. But this masterclass breaks down the neuroscience behind passion, behind how to create and unlock more passion in your life in a way that actually facilitates more access to flow, more frequent access to flow. And it's called The Passion Recipe. It's going to teach you the science and specific step-by-step methodology needed to coach your clients to help them discover their passion and access flow more consistently. You can also, of course, apply the model to yourself. So go to passionrecipe.com. If you want to check out the masterclass, that's passionrecipe.com. You can register for free and you can catch the whole thing at passionrecipe.com. Now let's dive back in to Remy. It's wild to be able to ask you about the SEALs, about dealing in the Bronx, and about what I'm about to ask you about now, which is your creative process. Yes. I'd love if you could tell folks a little bit about what you've learned in Hollywood in contrast to SEALs, and then what your creative process looks like both in Hollywood and then in terms of your writing and the book and everything as well?
Yeah, just to be clear, what I've learned in Hollywood as it relates to anything?
Yeah, as it relates, I mean, let's say the lessons, the principles that you've taken from Hollywood and been able to store in your...
You mean besides don't believe a word anything anybody says to you?
Yeah, well, that's one. That's one, right? Yeah, the thing is you can't trust anybody.
Yeah, right, what's the difference between the teams and Hollywood? Well, yeah. At least with the teams, they don't lie to you all the time.
All the time, exactly. It's like the that's the big one is, you know, trust, man. And again, that's been a really, over the years, it's been a really challenging thing for me, especially early on, because I came from an environment where, you know, trust was huge. And then having transitioned into an environment where you can't believe what anybody's saying at times.
People don't understand how difficult that environment is to perform it. Right. Yeah, it's, everybody's an unreliable matter. And even, you know, environments of uncertainty are the most difficult environments to work in. And Hollywood, even if you're working with great people who are not dishonest, everybody around them is less than truthful. Let's say, let's be generous, less than truthful. And it's a culture that it is incredibly difficult to do. I mean, in any of those are the conditions that produce burnout, right? Like, it doesn't matter. And Hollywood's built on them. I don't think people understand how difficult it is to transition from a place like the teams where you can trust everybody to Hollywood, where literally nothing anybody says to you is the truth, even if they're trying to tell you the truth, probably.
Yes, no, 100%. And like, I've had people who I've, like, really, really close friends who I've trusted, and I still do trust, who've said, hey, you need to meet this person in Hollywood. Like, I'm friend, they're a great person, they're this, they're that, they'll never screw you up. And then I'll meet them and we'll, you know, become acquainted and maybe do some. And then they lie or they do something. And I'm just like, what the heck? Like, you came from a trusted source. So it's very, very hard. And, you know, as you said, a big part of it is everybody's scratching and clawing to win. You know what I mean? To get, and the term is get something made. And people will do anything to get a project made. And, you know, it's just one of those things that's unfortunate. But me and a good friend of mine, we joke about it all the time. He's a writing partner on a TV show. He's one of the co-writers of this TV show we're doing together. And he said, hey, it's the business that we chose. it's like we're masochists, man. It's the business that we chose. But it is very challenging. But it's rewarding too. You know, it's when that project gets picked up or when I get that phone call saying, you know, we're going to do this project or we're going to move forward. It's rewarding. I got that phone call 2 weeks ago from a massive, massive producer. Massive. I can't mention his name. But if I said his name, I mean, everybody, he does blockbuster movies. And he actually found out about me because he came across my book at a beach a year ago. And interestingly, my agent sent him this film that I wrote. And, you know, he's like, we got on a call. And he's like, I want to do this movie. We want to do this movie. And so, you know, I say a lot to say it's those moments are super rewarding, but those moments are few and far between. That's another thing about Hollywood. Hollywood should be called Rejection Central, because Hollywood is nothing but reject. You get rejected. Everybody gets rejected. Every single body gets rejected. Studios get rejected. Producers get rejected. Actors get rejected. Writers get, everybody gets rejected. And it's this environment where you have to learn how to deal with rejection. And one of the things that I pull from my past that helps me now today is I've been rejected my whole life. You know, so for me, it's just like, hey, Remy, you've been rejected. You could deal with this level of rejection. This is your whole life. So that's one thing that I definitely do pull into this job.
Did you get back to Africa?
I went back 2 years ago. I went and visited my dad's island and visit some of my family out there. It was a great experience.
Can you tell us a little bit, Remy, about your approach as a coach and a consultant and the work you do on that side of things and the speaking end?
Yeah, so consulting in the film and TV space or consulting on the in the business athletic space?
Yeah, I'd love to hear in the business athletic space.
Yeah, actually, interestingly, I got into it during the end of my career in the SEAL teams. I was working in this office called the Motivators Office, and essentially the SEAL teams, going back to what I mentioned as it relates to teams, like guys you know, who make it, that common thread is they have learned, or they have, you know, they've transitioned into learning how to work as a team. For years, the SEAL teams and the Navy's been trying to figure out how do we change the attrition rate, because attrition rate's been anywhere between 75% and 90% at times. And one of those common threads they found is that a high percentage of guys who do make it through SEAL training are guys who have had a background in team sports, especially Division I sports. And so the motivator's office where I was working at, they would put on these clinics, I want to call them clinics, where they would allow high school athletes, collegiate athletes, Olympians, and even some pro athletes to come go through like a mini buzz. And it was twofold, you know. Part of it was for the players and the coaches was to expose them to SEAL principles that translates into sports, you know, critical thinking, mental toughness, communication, leadership, all that kind of stuff, but also use it as somewhat of a recruitment tool. So, you know, to expose these guys to the training. So in the case, like their sports dreams didn't work out, they could say, hey, you know what? There's another team I could be a part of, the SEAL teams. And so I would help run those programs, those training sessions from time to time. And so when I got out, I co-founded a company where we would do that. We would essentially put on those clinics. We would do a class on the topics. So there was an actual curriculum where, you know, like, so one class was mental toughness, where we really broke down the four pillars of mental toughness. Another class was critical thinking. Another class was communication. We did these classes, and then we had the practical application where we would go out, and for the athletes, we would put them through essentially like a mini buds, like a mini SEAL training, really emphasizing those principles that we taught them in a classroom. On the corporate side of things, obviously, you know, working with businesses, everybody's not in the best shape, and you got to worry about waivers and all this other stuff. So we created, you know, programs that can still be used, but they're not to the level of an athletic. So somebody who's 60 or 70 years old, an executive, can still participate and still get the practical application from the principles that we taught them in the classroom. So that's what I have done since before I even got out of the SEAL teams, 2015. And what I still do from time to time, I don't do it as much as I used to because of my schedule in the film and TV industry. You know, a lot of the consulting I do in the film and TV industry, but that's the basis of my business, sports consulting.
What did you find made the biggest difference with the business folks? What change or what thing that you guys would do with them had the biggest return?
We would do towards the end of every session, we would do, I forgot what, well, I'm trying to think of the term. It was a final training exercise. And essentially, it was something for each organization. It was something that they were going through at that time. So they had to put together, if they, for example, and I'm not saying we did this, but this is just an example. If one of the reasons why the company brought us in was because they were having a really tough time with retention or recruitment and finding the right people, and it was an HR company, that the lab or the practical, the final training exercise was building a plan, like building an actual recruitment retention plan, utilizing the principles that we taught, whether it be communication, reading people, whatever it is. So building that plan and then presenting that plan to not just to us as the cadre, but also presenting that plan to the entire organization, but then also opening up the room for like really harsh feedback, right? So not, I don't want to say harsh feedback, but real feedback. And so somewhat of an AAR, after action report. So after they did this brief, people were able to pick it apart. And one thing that we would tell, because usually when we get hired to do this, we would get hired by the CEOs or the presidents or the founders of these companies. And we would tell them, hey, listen, when we do this, you're not the CEO. You're not the president. You're not the co-owner or the founder or whatever. You're at the same level as them. We want this event or evolution to happen in such a way that everybody feels comfortable voicing their opinion and being honest and not feeling like they're going to lose their job. And so once we created that, whatever that lab was that was specific to that organization, and we put together that AAR, and it was, and then we had that open room discussion at the end, that was the most fruitful I found for the organizations. And I remember there were times like weeks, months later, I would get a phone call from the CEO, and you know, he would just say, thank you. You know, that style of AAR where we take off our rank and have those conversations, those hard conversations, we're still doing it to this day. And we're seeing the benefit of doing it this way. So that, again, that was what I would say was the most fruitful on the business, on the consulting as it relates to businesses.
That makes total sense, Rami. Thanks for sharing that. Your the subtitle of your book is epic, by the way, A Navy SEAL's Unlikely Journey from the Throne of Africa to the Streets of the Bronx to Defying All Odds. Yeah. Love it. What was the biggest thing you were hoping
for? I wrote that subtitle, by the way. Nice. The publisher wanted something completely different. They didn't want that, but I pushed back and I was like, come
it's
on.
Tight. Yeah, I love it. Right.
You got to sell a book. You want people to pick up the book and you say, okay, I want to buy this book off the cover.
Exactly. Good copy. What's the biggest thing that you were hoping in writing the book that people would be left with after reading it, would you say? Before answering that, definitely encourage everyone to pick up a copy. The book's called Transformed, and you guys know the subtitle as well.
The biggest thing I wanted people to realize that they can change, and that other people can change. That's the biggest thing. You know, I get so many messages from people all across the world who've read the book, and they say to me, Remy, like, I feel like I can now change into a better person. Or I feel like I can now go after that job or that dream that I've had for so many years after reading this book. And that was my goal. I wanted people to walk away and say, I can now be transformed. And I wanted people to also walk away along, and you know, the dovetails that other people can be transformed. Other people can change. And other people need second chances, right? In the society we live in now, there's this term called cancel culture, right? Everybody's getting canceled. It's just like, and I just wanted people to realize that, listen, it's people who need second chances. And sometimes it's you need a second to give yourself a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance. And that's how you can transform into that new person or transform and get closer to that dream, is by giving yourself a second, third, fourth chance or somebody else. So that was a big thing I wanted people to walk away from. Interestingly, one thing that I'm shopping now, and I'm probably not going to do it with the same publisher, so maybe Steve, you can point me in the right direction, the new publisher, but I want to do a self-help version of Transform. You know, I'm taking some of the stories in the book, new stories, but kind of laying out a blueprint to help people find personal transformation in their own life. Just get closer to it, essentially. That was my goal. I wanted people to walk away and say, man, I want a reference point. Going back to our early discussion, I wanted to give people a reference point on transformation and say, wow, here's this guy who started at the bottom. There's absolutely no reason why that guy should transform into who he is today and who he's continuing to transform into, right? Because for me, it's an ongoing process, right? Like, I'm a writer now. I get frustrated sometimes when people just use that title, Navy SEAL. And I get it, because people are just like, oh, well, he was a Navy SEAL, that's a big thing. But, you know, I'm not a Navy SEAL anymore, dude. Like, I was a Navy SEAL. But here's who I am now. And who knows who I'll be in the next 5 years. And because I've had these multiple transformations, like, I want to be open to more transformations, different transformations.
Hold on. I heard you want to be open to more transformations. I heard Michael Bay called you. The first thing you did was turn him down. You were like, who is that asshole? I don't want anything to do with that. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, Well, it was not him directly, but it was his somebody who worked for him who reached out to me and was just like, hey, we'd like for you to work on this movie. And Michael Bay is actually how, you know, I got into the business. But I didn't want to do the job. But like, going back to that point, I was open. Because I was actually in grad, when I received that phone call to work on Transformers, I was in grad school. I was finishing up my master's in organizational strategy. I wanted to get my master's so that I could work more in the consulting space, in the consulting business space and athletic space. And the last thing I ever wanted to do was be in Hollywood. The absolute last thing. It was nowhere on my radar. And so I said, I like to say, when I got that phone call and I was asked, reality, I didn't want to do it. But a part of me said, be open. Just go see and see what happens. And I did. And it's led to this crazy career now in Hollywood where I'm at today.
Remy, what's the next? Maybe you don't know, but if you had to give a sense of your goals or plan or trajectory, what's the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years look like? I'm wondering how many careers we're going to end up having.
He's just working on the sequel to the book that's going to talk about his astronaut career. So it's going to be space, right? Like, that time is done.
Well, there's two things I don't mess with in this universe is wild animals and outer space. I'm terrified of wild animals and outer space. Those are my some things that I don't know yet. But who knows? Who knows? Man, the next 5 years, dude, like, my goal right now, my sole focus is directing. Is writing and directing my first film. I was just blessed with financing from a major billion-dollar funder. And so I was blessed with this financing to be able to direct my first film. And so...
Action or a drama?
Action drama. It's a true story. It's the true story of the first group of African Americans to serve in special operations.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's never been told. It's one of those stories where I came across, I was like, this should have been a movie 10 times already. But, you know, it hasn't. And one of the reasons why it hasn't is because, you know, it's expensive to tell the story. And so I wrote the film. I came across a story. I pretty much secured the rights in my own way, and I wrote the film, and then I was able to secure financing. So I'm going to, as of right now, co-direct the film with another director that's more experienced, and then hopefully that'll lead to me directing more movies. I want to tell more stories. I want to, and you know, all the stories I want to tell, you know, just like with Transform, I want them to be stories that people will walk away from the movie theater or the TV show, and they'll walk away a better person, or they walk away with a lesson and say, wow. So that's my goal, I would say, for the next five to 10 years is tell stories on a larger scale and really be the conductor behind the storyteller and not just like a part of it.
Were you always a storyteller?
Looking back to my early teen years, I probably would say that's when the bug bit me. My mother, she was always into the arts. And one of the ways she tried to combat me going down the wrong path in the Bronx was she would save her pennies, man. We were poor, but she would save her money and she would try to take us to a movie theater where she could, or she would try to take us to a play. She would take jobs at art galleries and museums, and she would, you know, take those jobs so that me and my brother could go to the museum or art gallery for free and learn. And so storytelling has always been a part of me. And I would say that in my early teen years, that's when I really began to realize my love for storytelling. I didn't know how that was going to manifest, but
Nice, Rami. Well, this is epic, man. I want to ask you one final question, and then maybe Stephen has a few final ones, and maybe you have a few final thoughts. One of the questions we love asking, we call the research genie question. We started asking this question to researchers, so we'll do a modified version. But the question is basically, if you could instantly have the research done to answer any question at all, what would that question be? And it does not necessarily need to be research-based or anything like that. But I'm curious, if you were to instantly be able to get the answer to any question, what would the question be?
Well, that's a great question. How did you come up with the question is maybe the answer. What would that question be? Got it. Unity. What is the fastest way? What is the best way we... as a nation, specifically as a nation, just start with the nation, can have unity. Like, what I would want is that answer to be implemented and immediately solve the problem. So that's the type of answer I'm looking for. What would it take? And it may not just be like one quick answer. It may be like a big answer. Like, here are the actual steps. But yeah, man, it's unity. How can we get unity in the nation? On every side of the spectrum, not just like, I know the first thing that comes to mind is political. I don't just mean political unity. I mean unity as it relates to race and politics and education and just everything across the board. Is how.
All right, Remy, since I get to ask the last question, I'm going to ask you to answer your own question.
Yeah.
What's it going to, like, okay, you've run with and in and high-performing teams all over the place. Let's say the country is a giant high-performing team. And I'm just curious, if you were coming at this question of unity as a just knowing what you know about high performance, how would you approach it?
I would say understanding. I think that's the first step. Just thinking about a team and how do you operate in a team effectively. In order for a team to operate effectively, the guys within that team, regardless of their backgrounds or their differences, they have to gain some level of understanding of the other teammates. Because in my opinion, understanding is what leads to empathy. And once you can have empathy for that teammate, whether they have the same political beliefs or not, or grew up in the same background or not, then you can begin to have unity. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but I don't think that can be the overall solution. well, that can't be the overall solution. But I just think that it always comes back to understanding, and the way understanding can come is through conversation. And I talk about this in my book. Less than 1% of Navy SEALs are African-American. That's just the way it's always been. I was the only African-American that graduated in my class. I've been in multiple classes, and at max, there's been 3 African-Americans starting out of 270, 250 guys.
I've never asked this question. Is that true with the Rangers and the Green Berets, et cetera, or is it just specific to the teams? Is it spec ops in general that's not attracting African-Americans, or is it the SEALs?
I think from what I've heard, because I've spoken to, there's another Ranger I'm really good friends with, and he said that the rates of African-Americans in Ranger Battalion percentages are low as well. I don't think they're as low as the SEAL teams, but they are low. And from what I hear across the board, across the spectrum, when you come across an African-American Green Beret or African-American MARSOC guy, it's just like, oh, wow, you know, like, that doesn't happen. So from what I understand, I would have to...
That doesn't even make sense to me based on the numbers, the racial breakdown of who's in the military. Like, that makes zero... Yeah, okay.
I know.
We're going to leave it all alone, but
yeah,
please...
I got a whole long answer to that, man. And it starts way before the military to me. I mean, I think it starts with education. It starts with proper resources in specific environments. I'll leave it there. But I say all that to say, you know, the good thing about that, and I say this carefully, is when I was in SEAL training with all of these white guys, I was able to have these deep conversations, because when you suffer with somebody in SEAL training, then you begin to trust them a little bit more. You begin to trust, okay, like, this person is not just talking out their ass, or they're just saying something in order to win an argument. This may be like how it truly is, or how they truly see it from their perspective. And so when I was in SEAL training, I had tough conversations with guys about race in America, about what it was like growing up as a black kid in the Bronx, and what I witnessed cops do, what happened to me as a kid as it relates to the police. And I was able to share these experiences, and these guys were just like, man, we've come to know Remy over the last few weeks in SEAL training, and we see that he's a hard charger, we see he doesn't complain, and we see that, man, maybe what he's saying is right. And then on the flip side, I would talk to these kids who, you know, they came from affluent backgrounds. Interestingly, a lot of guys who go to SEAL training, they come from money, dude. Like, this is the craziest thing. They come from very affluent families. Some of them were in the corporate world, and they decided one day they wanted to be a Navy SEAL, and so they dropped everything to be a SEAL. And I was able to talk to these guys, and they were able to share their experiences with me. And some of them, they had dads who were, or moms who were in law enforcement, and they were able to share their experiences. And through those conversations, yeah, we may not have walked away completely agreeing with each other's perspective, but we walked away with a level of understanding. And as we walked away with that level of understanding, we began to empathize with each other more, especially as we move forward in SEAL training. And then as we begin to empathize more, that began to breed more unity. And, you know, case in point, I'll give you this example. One of the things I struggled with big time in SEAL training was the 2-mile time ocean swim. Every week, we had to do a 2-mile time ocean swim in the Pacific Ocean, and the passing time was 85 minutes, and I was swimming it in 120 minutes. And like literally towards the end of every swim, I was either hypothermic or borderline hypothermic. And I remember in my first time in first phase, the instructors knew that I was going to be the last one out and I was going to take forever. And what they did was while I was still in the water with my swim buddy and the rest of the class had finished their swim, they started hammering the rest of the class. And they would tell the rest of the class, they would say, you know why you guys are getting beat? Because your buddy is can't swim, and he showed up and he sucks. And so we're going to just do this to you every single time. Every single swim, we're going to hammer you. And I remember finishing those swims, and those guys never gave me grief. They were always like, dude, Remy, we understand that you didn't have a background in swimming. We understand that you came from an environment where there was no pools or clean pools or resources. We understand, and we know that you crush it in every other aspect as it relates to training. And because we've gained that understanding, having had conversations with you, we empathize with you. So instead of us making you quit, because that's what classes would do at times, classes would make the guy who struggled or the guy who didn't pull his weight they would make him or make him quit and say, dude, quit. They never did that to me. They always supported me. And then eventually I figured it out and I got through SEAL training. So back to your question, conversation leads to understanding. Understanding leads to empathy, and empathy takes empathy before we can have unity.
Tom. See, his own research, Genie.
Exactly.
My work here is done.
Sure. Well, obviously it's not working, so it might not be the answer.
It's all of the execution, my friend.
Yeah. That's true.
Remy, any final words before we wrap? And if you could also mention where folks can find more about you as well, that'd be great.
No, once again, thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me on. You know, it's been an honor and a blessing. And I can be found on any social media platform, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's all the same. Remy Adeleke. I was blessed with a unique name, so it doesn't have to be the official Remy Adeleke. It's just Remy Adeleke. Anybody can get a hold of me there. My book, Transformed, is on everywhere where books are sold, Barnes & Noble's, Amazon, BAM, anywhere where books are sold, you can get the book. Once again, thanks for having me on.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Remy. Yeah, you're the man. Appreciate it.
If what you've heard on Flow Research Collective Radio has been helpful, please consider doing us a solid and leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this. Reviews help us connect to a wider audience so we can get these peak performance principles out to more people.